We are in Shoktim Perakya Tet. This abysmal story of Pilegish Begivah, the concubine. Last time we really got into the ugliest part of this story. It's really obvious on a personal level. You'll see more that we don't like later on. But you had the man and the concubine, neither of whom have names. And the concubine had left the man. We don't know fully what the story was. We had different explanations for what had happened. The word vatizneh was used. We didn't know exactly what that meant. Whether it means that she had been unfaithful to him, whether it was that she walked out, as the Gemara brings, she walked out because of his display of anger. He waits 4 months. He goes to find her. He goes to her father's house. Her father is very excited to see him and very happy to have him there and wants to have him stay. We suggested various explanations for what this is meant to highlight. Maybe it highlights hospitality, which is nice, and also a contrast with what's coming next. Maybe not. We had the simple explanation of Malbim. He doesn't want her to be stuck because he doesn't want her anymore. It'll be hard for her to find somebody else. Or you take the view that it's more like a marriage relationship, in which case she'd actually be an aguna. So that's why he wants he's excited to see the guy, and he wants the guy to stay in the house. Alternatively, Ralbag, the Levi, this fellow we do know, he's a Levi, has great social standing, and the father wants him to be happy and to keep him in the house. Or, Ricky had suggested maybe it's about the contrast with what's coming next, where they're so hostile to strangers. Or the last, consistent with the whole theme of greed in this section of Sefer Shoftim, is that the father had sold her off. That's how she ended up as a Pilegish in the first place. So, welcome back. Mazel tov. Consistent with the theme of greed in this section, the father perhaps had sold her off as a concubine, and now is greedy because he wants this fellow to stay, and he's anticipating getting more from him. So either way, the fellow stays 3 days, then he stays the fourth day, then finally on the fifth day, after a big meal, he says, "Enough, I'm leaving," and they head north to go back home to Har Ephraim. They reach Giv'ah, right? He wants to press on and go even further. On the other hand, his servant had wanted to stop off at Yavus. They end up staying at Giv'ah, which looks like a nice place. It's a nice Jewish town. Okay. When they're in Giv'ah, they're not able to find a place to stay. There is no hospitality. They're going to camp out in the square until somebody who is himself not a native, someone who is himself a stranger, invites them in. They emphasize, "We're going to the Beit Hashem. We're going to Shiloh, where the Mishkan is," which may be true. He actually is going there because that's his city in Har Ephraim. Or it's not true, but he just wants to emphasize, "I'm not a worshiper of the Micha statue," since the stranger is also from Har Ephraim, so he might think that that's who they are, that's their identity, and therefore I'm making myself more attractive as a guest if I tell him that I'm associated with the Mishkan. I'm an okay person. You can have me in your house. So, which of course he's not, as we find out. They go to the gentleman's house. This is the man, his servant, and the Pilegesh.
They go from the square to somebody else's house.
Correct.
In the same town, or
same town. And the older man is there, and apparently he has a daughter in the house as well, as we find out in the course of the story. The people of the city surround the house, and they are described as Anshei Belial, terrible people of no value, people of no worth, and they threaten the people inside. They want the man taken out specifically so they can abuse him. They offer the host's daughter as well as the Pilegesh. The people outside say they're not interested. That's not what they want. The man, nonetheless, the visitor, nonetheless, grabs his Pilegesh, forces her out of the house, and the people of the city abuse her. Ultimately, she ends up on the doorstep with her last bit of strength. And that's what we had read up to. Yeah.
What is the origin? What is the reason for the euphemism, "He knew her," to know somebody?
Right. So it's a good question. It's not a euphemism. meaning the as a verb biblically, that term is used to refer to intimacy. And intimacy may be knowledge in the sense of intellectual knowledge, but it may just as well be them being with her sexually. That will count as yada. It's not a euphemism. That's the word that's used.
So it's not necessarily sexual.
It's correct. Sometimes it just means knowledge. Sometimes it just means intellectual knowledge.
You know as in you recognize, or you know as you
correct.
Know about them?
Correct.
But it's still used very specifically. I mean, everybody knows everybody, but it's still used very specifically more towards the...
No, it's used in general context also. When we talk about Eitz Hadaat Tovara, we generally assume that that's knowledge. You know, intellectual knowledge. There is something to say about that tree also, but generally speaking, no, it can be used in both contexts. Yeah.
But certainly the language moved evolved since then to only.
You mean non-Hebrew?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean within Hebrew itself, the way people use the term today? Could be.
Really, when you say Yadah Asher Koneu.
Right. No, that's true.
I don't think you wanted.
That's true. But it is a strong, that example is an example of a strong type of knowledge, and it's not simply awareness of a fact that is my owner. Rather, it's a deeper comprehension that there is an owner.
Comprehension and understanding.
Correct.
That's the key
right.
of it, yeah.
Yeah. So I forgot to mention at the beginning, but the shiur today is actually dedicated by the Growers in memory of Liba's mother, Sarah Dina Dvorah Bas Yaakov, whose yard site is listening.
So who's that?
Yeah. Liba Grauer's mother.
Okay. Can she take this lesson?
Yeah. I mean, she's not here now. She had a baby, but yes. Okay. So that brings us to Perek Yetet, chapter 19, Pasuk Chav Zayin, sentence 27. 27, 28 is what we're up to. Anybody need a sheet? Okay. Vayakam Adonai HaBaboker. So, 27, Chazayin. So, she has collapsed at the entrance of the house. Vayakam Adonai HaBaboker. Her Adon, and I think we actually read this pasuk last time as an introduction, but her Adon gets up in the morning and we call him an Adon. Oh, you know why? Because we saw it in Chavav also. That's what I'm thinking of. We saw the usage already in Chavav. The Adon as a master, as opposed to a husband, because this is the way he has treated her. He gets up in the morning. Vayiftach dalsos habayis. He opens the doors of the house. Vayetzei lachas ledarko. It's time to go home. Vihine ha'isha filaksho nofeles. And the pilagesh has fallen. Pesach habayis, the entrance to the house. V'yadeha al hasaf, with her hand on the saf, the saf, the edge of the entrance. Saf is used sometimes as a lintel. Maybe it would be that. Maybe actually no. Sometimes it's a bowl. In the Torah, it's a bowl. In Parshas Bo, Adam Asher Basaf. Well, that's the bowl that's in the saf, right? But that's not the term for the lintel there. There it's a mashkof. It's a threshold, yeah. It's the, so...
He didn't realize that she wasn't there in the house?
He knew full well. He knew full well that she wasn't in the house. He knew exactly where she was.
He gave her the night before.
And her hand is there. Vayomer Eileh, just wait. You have one more pasuk. Vayavo Eileh, he says to her, Kumi v'neilecha. No, let's go. Ve'ein oneh. And there's no response because she's dead. So he takes her body on the donkey. And he goes home. Says nothing, does nothing, just takes her body and goes back home.
She's dead or passed out?
She is dead.
It's very clear as the story continues.
Mine says he evidently thought she was alive.
I don't know why they say evidently. It's not evident to me in any way, shape, or form. But, okay, who are they quoting? Or is that
doesn't
their own?
Say.
Usually they give you, like, somebody in parentheses.
No.
Nope. Then it's their own idea.
Said she was dead.
I mean, everyone says she's dead. He just, what Debbie's seeing in the Sansino is that they're saying that he takes her back home because he thinks she's alive.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing here to say that she's dead.
Trust me, if you want to read another couple of psukim, she's dead.
I don't want to read it. Yes. Yes. I mean, at this point,
answer is she's dead. Whether he knows or not, the general commentaries assume that he knows full well and that he's planning something. She is dead.
He didn't expect her to be on the threshold.
No.
Door, but he didn't expect her to be alive.
Right. No, some of the commentators actually believe that he anticipated that whatever was going to happen was going to happen, and she's going to be at the city gate waiting for him in the morning. That's the way that they read it, and that it's a surprise to him that she's at the doorstep. When he speaks to her, he thinks she's alive. But then she doesn't answer, and at that point,
she died during the night.
It is definitely, a message to us, the fact that he sleeps through the night and has no problem doing so.
He wasn't worrying
about it. But we don't know, they might have taken her away someplace.
But if you remember the story in Daniel, right? Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den. King Darius stays up all night. He can't sleep because he is so agitated and upset because he didn't want to end up with that. He was trapped into throwing Daniel into the lion's den. It was not his desire to do so, and he's upset. And it says specifically he can't sleep. Right, Achashverosh can't sleep. This guy
gave her away, and that's it.
Yeah.
Well, she obviously left her for a good reason in the first place.
Right. Well, that's what yes, she should have stayed left.
She shouldn't have gone back.
She'll come in this case.
So it's really, it's really remarkable that he was able to sleep. On the other hand, when he doesn't talk to anyone, does that signify that now something has struck him? Like, something actually made a dent. He doesn't go talk to anybody. He doesn't, there's no dialogue, there's no nothing. He just leaves. He goes home. No. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
No, but I'm saying maybe he's not like contemplating. Maybe he's just like thinking of what he's going to do next.
I mean, even that shows that it made an impact. Something is different for him. He's not the guy we saw before who's having this nice, polite conversation with the host. He's not the guy who was at the in-law's house, right? Where they schmoozed with him and he stayed for the morning. He's different at this point.
He'd like to just get up and leave. This is what he's doing.
Or this is what he was trying to do all along, right, before he couldn't get away with it. I don't know. It's hard because you can really project many different things. Here, the text is just so brief that it's hard to tell.
So the host just disappears.
The host isn't in the
from
picture.
The story.
Correct. And we won't see him again. He's done. So the big question that you have to have when you read this story, right, now that we've seen what happens in this town, is, so why doesn't God simply wipe them out? Meaning Stone, right, got wiped out. So, like, why are these people still here? So the simple answer is the age of miracles is gone. Right? God doesn't do stuff like that anymore. In the beginning of Bereshis, he's teaching us what it is that he values and what it is that he does not value. That's Ramban on Sefer Bereshis. The whole point of that book is to calibrate, for us to learn what God likes and what God does not like. So that's early on, but afterwards people do terrible things and God does not strike them down with lightning. That's a simple answer.
But it wasn't the whole town, was it?
Well, the whole town's in the boat, initially.
That's a good question.
Right.
So take a look at Ramban. Ruth leads us towards Ramban. Ramban, writing on the story with Sodom, makes the comparison. He says, or contrast, he says, V'da v'havein, know and understand. Kinyan pilegish begiv'ah. Avo pishu nidmele inyan hazeh. Einenu kamohu laroa. He says, Pilegish Begiva looks an awful lot like Sodom. However, it's not as bad. It's not the same in terms of its evil. Ki harasha'im ahem lo hayadatam l'chalos ha'regel mimikomam. He says, in our story, meaning Pilegish Begiva, it's not an anti-traveler, anti-passerby, we don't want to help anybody type of an attitude. Aval hayushtufei zima. They're simply thoroughly immoral. In other words, it's not that, in the story with Sodom, the idea is they have a rule. right? They tell Lot, like, who are you coming from the outside to tell us what to do? We have a rule locally. There are no guests. We don't help anybody out. We don't share. Our assets are for us. Everybody else has to fend for themselves. If they're outside our city, they can be fine. Just don't come in here and look for us to help you. That's Sodom. And that's a unique brand of immorality in the sense that it reflects this this pure hostility and coldness towards others. That's Sodom. Whereas here, if the if they're not, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, if they're not attracted to the person, if they don't find this person to be something that sparks their desire, then sure, help them. Give them a drink, let them stay overnight. We have no problem being nice to people. It's just that, you know, there is this...
Nobody
takes them in, but Ramban ignores that. He doesn't look at that as evidence that they are hostile to strangers, even though you're right, that's a weakness of his argument. He continues to say, and he says further, as Ruth said, it's not everybody. In Sodom, it actually said, the entire nation, young to old, everybody attacks the house. Here it said, Anshei Belial, Anshei Ha'ir. People who were wicked, people of the city, but it's not the whole city.
So,
right, it's a gang. That's exactly right. Malvim takes the same approach. He's similar to Ramban, but he provides a little bit more to back up this this idea that they're not as bad as Sodom. You have to remember who Sodom is for us. Which two nations emerge from Sodom?
Moab and Amalek.
Amalek.
No, Ammon and Moab. Okay. Amalek is the grandson of Esav. Different family. Ammon and Moab are the ones who emerge from there. They are known for not helping. Right? When the Torah says, don't let the Ammoni and the Moavi marry in, because Alasher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim, when you wanted to go into Israel, they would not give you food. Right? And then also the matter of hiring Bilam, which we also didn't like. But even that, even hiring Bilam, what's the motivation in hiring Bilam?
To curse the Jews.
Right, but why? Why do they want to curse the Jews?
Because the Jews are coming into their town.
Because the Jews are coming to their town. They're not concerned that we're going to fight them. Number one, we're not allowed to. They may not know that. However, what they say is they're going to come in here and they're going to eat up all of the produce. They're going to lick up everything around us like an ox licking up all the grass. They don't want to share. It's the identity of Sodom passed down in Ammon and Moab, which is why, if you remember the story with in the beginning of Sefer Rus, right? Elimelech wants to move out. There's a famine here. Megor says he doesn't want to share his wealth. And where does he go?
Moab.
That's the identity that Moab carries for us. We talked about this way, way back in Shoftim when we actually faced Moab as an enemy. We saw it back then. That's who Moab is. And that's the way we look at Sodom, therefore. And so our picture of Sodom is, it's not so much that they wanted to abuse visitors for their own desires, it's that they don't want to share. They don't want anybody to benefit from what is theirs. So take a look at source number two, the Malbim, expanding on the idea that we already saw in Ramban. He says, Manishtana inyan hagiv'a, he says, what's the difference between the matter of Giva, right, our story, and the sin in Sodom, where God rains down fire and brimstone, right, and he uproots the city? They did as Sodom did, right? We noted last time all the shared language. And yet, God doesn't do anything to punish them. So he says, they have explained, they, Ramban certainly, have explained there's a difference between the Rasha and the Chote, the wicked and the sinner. Rotzelomar, meaning, Ki anshei Sodom hayachet amitzar haseichel, the sin of Sodom is intellectual. Ki chakeku lahem chukim lo tovim, umishpatim bal yechiyu bahem chayei hamedineyut. He says, in Sidon, they made bad rules. They made statutes by which political life, as I wrote here, cannot live. It's a play on a pasuk in Yechezkel, which I referenced for you on the sheet. Lo chein anshei ha-giv'ah. Giv'ah's not like that. Lo sichlam haya b'mal hazeh. There's no intellect involved in what they did. V'lo b'nei chok v'nimus asuzos. It wasn't a function of their laws, like, you know, there's a law that strangers have to be abused. Rach b'nei ta'avasam. It's a function only of desire. V'abachinam hazeh. And he says, here's my evidence. First, Lot hichnis ha-malachim b'seser. Lot brought in the malachim in secret. Right, that's why you need the Medrash to explain how it is that the neighbors knew that there even were guests in Lot's house. Right, the answer is that Lot's wife went to get salt, and that's why she got punished with salt. The hazaken begeva hechnisa sola beso beparhesia, whereas the elder brought them in public, and that's how everybody knew that they were there. Beis sham kasuv anshei ha'ir anshei sedom nasabu al abayis minar ve'azaken. The point that we already saw, that Ruth had anticipated. Ramban said it as well, that in Sodom it says the entire city. Right? It emphasizes anshei sedom nar azaken, young to old. Gimel, third point. Shanksiv nasabu al habayit. He says, in the story in Sodom, it says that they surrounded al habayit, which I underlined, upon the house, meaning they actually wanted to punish Lot, because how dare you break our laws? We have a law, you weren't taking guests. We noted when we read the story, when this host left the house, he didn't close the door behind him. In Sodom, Lot actually shuts the door behind him because he's afraid they're going to attack the house. Lo chein po, not here. It just said he went out to them. He knows they're not going to be so bold as to enter his house. That they wouldn't do, because they don't have the right of law behind them. In Sodom, they are the law. This mob is carrying out the laws of Sodom. And Dala, the fourth point, Sha'amar lahem shehi nivala. When the host tried to get them to desist, he said, this would be a disgusting thing for you to do.
What is Aleph Lamed, Slicha?
Sha'amar lahem. Amar lahem.
Amar lahem.
Yeah. Shehi nivala. He told them that it would be disgusting to do this in Pilegish Begiva. Harei hayas sichlam shalem hakir shehi nivala. That assumes that they actually would view it as disgusting. Otherwise, what's he arguing?
Maybe his town it is.
Right, maybe there it's not. This could be also. So that's the way that that Malbim looks at this. He has more. I brought you a lot of it, but not the full text. But what they're trying to do is to show you that this really isn't Sodom, as awful and horrible as it is, with the primary goal of explaining why it is that God doesn't punish them, although you sort of wonder if it isn't also, we can't believe that we'd really be Sodom. Like, there has to be some line between us and them somewhere. And maybe that's a little bit of the motivation
to
doing
this. Is an Israelite.
Yeah, it was emphasized, right? It was emphasized. That's why he goes there instead of going to Yebus.
We don't do that here.
Well, we'd like to think. So that's the that's this story, and now we get even more gruesome. Pasuk Chaf Tes and Lamed, sentences 29 and 30. So, preface before we read this: if there were a king, right? If you had a king, because we keep emphasizing in this era, there's no king of Israel and people do what they want. If there were a king, what would happen next?
There would be a trial of some sort.
Right? There would be a legal format for dealing with the problem. Right? You have a protocol. Maybe the protocol is that the Shevet has to take care of it. Maybe the protocol is that the city has some kind of a tribunal. Maybe the protocol is you go to the king and say, can you believe this happened? And the king comes in there and deals with it. Instead, what we're going to get here is this very chaotic response. So, take a look at Chavtet and Lamed, very Wild West. Vayavo al beso, the guy goes home. Vayikach es hama'achelet, and he takes a hatchet, right? Like akedah,
yeah,
type of a knife. Vayachazek befilag show, vayachazek, he grabs hold of the pilagesh, right? The same term that was used when he sent her out of the house, now is used here.
So now he realizes she's dead.
I hope so. And he cuts her into 12 pieces. Vayishalachah, thank you for putting out all this food. Vayishalachah, b'chol gevul Yisrael. And he sends the pieces throughout Israel with the following message. V'hayacho haro'eh, anybody who sees this, v'amar lo nihyasa, v'lo nirasa kazos, and will say, such a thing has never happened, has never been seen in our midst. L'miyom alos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim ad ha'yom hazeh, from the day we left Egypt until today. Simu lachem aleha utzu v'daberu. Simu lachem aleha can be translated in a couple of different ways. The simplest explanation is pay attention to this, like simu levavchem. Turn your attention to this, take counsel, speak of this. Something's got to be done. That mikra notes the other possibility is lasim can also be a reference to laying siege to something. So he's actually saying, let's go to war.
He's the one who did it.
Well, he's the one who sent her out.
Like, he sent her out, and he interrupts. And I'm saying, look at this disgusting
well,
thing.
Well, no. He's telling them the story of what happened. He doesn't include the story in the text here, which I'm kind of glad about, because I read it once, and that was enough. It's showing up again later.
Showing that they took her and defiled her. And
yes. He's trying to say...
And now look what this law is.
It's kind of like, he did a bad thing, and now he's... It's just like, hey, look what I just did.
Well, they won't believe him. And
if I did a crime, I did that. What are you going to start now? And he's basically admitting to all these people.
Well, he doesn't think he committed a crime.
He's absolving himself by saying,
you're going to see. You're going to see in another few psukim his version of what happened, and in his version of what happened, he did nothing wrong. They were attacked, his wife Pelegesh, concubine, was taken, and she was abused and killed. That's the way he views what happened. He doesn't see himself as having done something wrong.
So all he does is send the message.
So he's just sending a message to everybody else.
Messengers?
He sent them with messengers. I don't know if they paid FedEx to do this.
There's no refrigeration in those days.
We don't want to know.
But he sent it to say, let's go with our own people?
Yes.
Yes.
That is exactly what he wants. He wants a war against Givah. That's what he's looking for. Now,
also, do you know what that? I'm sorry, you get something like that from a messenger. I guess the messenger's saying what it is, but
when he goes to the town square,
it's not
the
Bible. I mean, it's not
like who does it go to?
Yeah. The town square.
Yeah, I guess the mayor.
Like a,
the mayor.
He hangs it up in the town square, and everybody hears about it.
Yeah, I mean, we have precedent for this. We have precedent for, well, in terms of humans, we have, the head of a general being stuck, you know, for everybody to see is something that we've seen. But also, Yechezkel Kaufman notes, take a look at the reference I gave you in number 3, to Shmuel, for those who have a Tanakh here. This is a story when Shaul is trying to lead the nation in war, and they send out a message that everybody better show up to the battle. And the message that they send is accompanied by, in this case, animal parts. Right? If someone has the text inside.
He cut up an ox into pieces. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah, read it.
And he took a pair of oxen and cut them into pieces, which he sent with the messengers throughout the land of Israel, saying, whoever does not go out after Saul and Samuel in battle, so shall be done to his oxen.
Right. So you're sending out the pieces in order to summon everybody to get involved, but there's a threat. Now I wonder if there isn't a threat here. If you don't do this, then I'm coming after you type of thing. I mean, yes.
We don't even know his name.
Yeah, they never mentioned his name.
He's a lady. He can get a job and done. Take a look at source number 4, where this shows up. Later in history, 2nd century Greek work called Taxaris. I found this thanks to a commentary on Pelagish Begiva that I found online. This is a story that has nothing to do with us, but you'll see the part that's relevant. And what is to be our course? Asked, I don't know if it's Mesentes or something along those lines. We will divide the work, replied the other. I, for my part, undertake to present our Sakomas with the head of Lucanor. You must bring him his bride. I agree. And you, Arsacomas, can stay at home, and as we are likely to want an army before we have done, you must be getting together horses and arms, and raise what men you can. A man like you will have no difficulty in getting plenty of people to join him, and there are all our relations. Besides, you can sit on the ox hide. The way for you to get to rally all the forces is sit on the ox hide, in which Lucian now explains what that means. Our custom of the hide is as follows. When a man has been injured by another and desires vengeance, but feels that he is no match for his opponent, he sacrifices an ox, cuts up the flesh, and cooks it, and spreads out the hide upon the ground. On this hide, he takes his seat, holding his hands behind him so as to suggest that his arms are tied in that position, this being the natural attitude of a suppliant among us. Meanwhile, the flesh of the ox has been laid out, and the man's relations and any others who feel so disposed come up and take a portion thereof, and setting their right foot on the hide, promise whatever assistance is in their power. One will engage to furnish and maintain 5 horsemen, another 10, a third some larger number, while others, according to their ability, promise heavy or light armed infantry, and the poorest, who have nothing else to give, offer their own personal services. The number of persons assembled on the hide is sometimes very considerable, nor could any troops be more reliable and more invincible than those which are collected in this manner, being as they are under a vow, for the act of stepping onto the hide constitutes an oath. So what you see is another example later in history, but this is, you know, in the early days, you want to rally people, you need some kind of a very graphic message. And here you see it with animal parts, and maybe that the fact that you're doing it with human beings represents another excess by these people who have no leader and are clearly just totally lost. I did see Kaufman quotes a German fellow named Zaplatal, or that Zaplatal is the way it's written in the Hebrew, who says that there was such a practice in Arab communities, but I haven't actually been able to find the original text. It's a German commentary to Schoftim. If I had it, I could do the Google Translate thing, but don't have it.
Like with Adam and the Reuben of Tarim, that was also like an oath, and they cut up animals in half. I mean, I don't know if that's just...
But it's not sent around to different places.
Right, but if you're saying it was a covenant, right? So like this is a covenant with the people, like to... I don't know.
Maybe. But yes, he sends these parts around through Israel. He wants everybody to join in and punish the people of Givah. Well, at least the people responded.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe that's valuable. Vayetzu, Perek Chaf, chapter 20. Vayetzu kol bnei Yisrael, all Israel came out. Vatikahel ha'eda ki ish echad, the nation gathered as one man. L'midan ve'ad Be'er Sheva, from Dun to Be'er Sheva. Dun to Be'er Sheva is a classic reference to the entire land, but this is the first time we see it. Meaning, we saw Abraham run all the way to Dun when he pursued the kings in that war of the 4 kings and the 5 kings, but it only becomes Dun in Pasalmicha, when Dun captures that land up north. So once you have that, you have Dun in the north, in Laish Leshem, and then your population goes all the way to Be'er Sheva down south.
Why doesn't it say Yehuda? Dun, like, you know, uses a tribe, and then they call the city Dun?
Yeah, they call the city Dun. And the end of that story that we read in Perek Yudchet, by Yikra'u Shem Ha'ir Dun.
Oh, Dun. Yeah. It's also the source of the Jordan among the...
Yes, that is the region. So we had some debate as to whether it was west of it or east of it, but yes, it's up there. The reference then is to the entire civilized area. Technically, you could have some people south of Be'er Sheva. It's just really hard to live and establish anything in the desert. And so what you'll have are Bedouins wandering around. You're not nomads. You're not going to have a city. Be'er Sheva is south, Dun is north, and he sends this message everywhere, and they all gather, all the people from Dun to Be'er Sheva, the Eretz HaGilad, as well as the land that's east of the Yarden, El Hashem, all of them gathered to God in Mitzpah, in a place called Mitzpah, which we're going to come back to in a moment. Vayisyatzevu pinos kol ha'am. The corners, literally, of the nation all stood. Kol Shivtei Yisrael, all the tribes of Israel. Bikahal Am HaElokim, in a gathering and an assembly of the nation of God. Arba Meos Elef Ish Ragli Sholev Charev, 400,000 men with swords.
And what did that mean?
So, we need to look at this story. The question of the size of it, is it really that large? Certainly when they're in the wilderness, you have 600,000 men of military age. And then presumably, again, they haven't grown much. We take the view that this is not right after, but this is somewhere 30 to 40 years after they enter the land. So it means that you have, you know, that size army, minus the people of Giv'a, presumably, minus whoever decided to stay home. We are going to see later on that this is not the whole army, because later on, in the next chapter, the last chapter of the book, they're going to declare an oath to summon everybody. So this is not really everybody just yet. Some may argue that this could be an exaggeration. I don't know, maybe. But what's weird here in these two psukim?
What's what?
What's strange here? What requires some explanation in these two psukim?
They all go to one place?
No, they were summoned. But
I mean, if this was such a normal thing to happen, to have people killed all the time, so why is everybody up in arms?
Well, I think that the barbaric aspect of the story involving her rape and the entire town is really what catches their attention. Plus the way he did it.
Or the people of Benjamin came anyhow. They didn't know what was going on.
Right. So we're going to find out about Benjamin and Pasuk Gimel. We'll see what they're doing. They're not in this gathering.
Why don't they go to Shiloh or Ephraim where they usually gather? Isn't that the place that you always say?
Right. So what's really strange here is we said they gathered to God in Mitzpah. The Mishkan's in Shiloh. Why are you gathering to God in Mitzpah? What does that even mean?
Where is it? Where's
Mitzvah? So we're going to talk about it in a second. It is on Har Ephraim, but we'll talk about it. We have seen Mitzvah before. That is correct. So we have two problems in one. Number one, why did you pick Mitzvah? And number two, God isn't in Mitzvah. So God is in Shiloh. I mean, God's everywhere, right? Hashem is here, Hashem is there. I understand that. But the Aron is in the Mishkan, and the Mishkan is in Shiloh. So it's not clear what you're doing here.
Is it mitzvah or mitzvah?
The wording in the pasuk is mitzvah, although it's the end of a pasuk, but mitzvah is usually smichut. Mitzvah something.
Mitzvah
rimon or something like that.
Mitzvah is usually a
smichut, when a word is linked to another word, it's modifying another word. The mitzvah of something. It's an overlook regardless. Whether you say mitzvah or mitzvah, it's an overlook. Mitzvah is the term, I think, that we use for an overlook. If it's the overlook of someone, the overlook of something, then it's mitzvah, whatever it is, but it's a smichut change of the vowels. As I think that's the way it works. Mitzvah Yericho would be another example, correct?
Mitzvah Ramon.
Right. But
wouldn't that be a reason to go to mitzvah because it's higher?
It's higher up.
And they can
that's nice, but why did you tell me that they gathered to God? And why that? Yes, mitzvah presumably is somewhere high up, but you need a better reason to be there.
How is it relevant to the area where Benjamin? How is it relevant to Giv'a?
It's nowhere near that. It's on Har Ephraim. No, hang on. Just hang on. Stop. So, two different approaches. One is Radak. Take a look, please, at source number 5. Radak here offers a suggestion, a simple one. Bamakom sheyiskavtsu kol Yisrael orubam, sham shechina shora. In a place where all Israel or the majority of Israel gather, Hashem is manifest. And he gives you psukim. We have various psukim that we use in Pirkei Avos, that we use in the Gemara, to say that Hashem is found where we are found. Hashem is found in where there's a minyan. Hashem is found in various places. So when it says before God, it doesn't mean in front of the Mishkan. It means God was present too. That's one explanation. However, go to source number 6, which is what Radak said in Yehoshua. In Yehoshua, we had a place called Mitzvah, and that was where the Jews defeated Yavin. Remember what happened. The Jews made their alliance with the Giv'onim by mistake. Giv'on then got attacked by Yavin and his allies, and at the end of that, and the Jews end up fighting their war against them. Actually, was Yavin that war or Yavin the next war? Yavin went in the follow-up war. Either way, there's a series of wars against great groups of Canaanite tribes, and they defeat Yavin at Mitzvah. So take a look at number 6, which is where Radak makes his comment. Ve'afshar, he says, it's possible, The mitzvah where they defeat Yavin could be the place where the Jews are going to gather perpetually in Tanakh. Because we'll see another gathering at mitzvah shortly. Because there was this great salvation there. He says, they chose that spot in particular because there was a great victory there. And even though Yoshua has another war against five kings where he does really well, that's not as big a deal as the war against Yavin. The war against Yavin is much bigger, and therefore that's the one. Ve'afshar, and then he says, it's possible, ki bana sham Yoshua mizbeach, mipnei ha-tshu'a gedola she'isa sham. It could be that Yoshua built an altar there because of the victory that they had over Yavin. So when we needed to go to war, or we needed to deal with some great issue, we would gather to mitzvah, to Yoshua's mizbeach. And that's what we find with Yiftach when he's going to go to war. Lifnei Hashem b'mitzvah, before God in mitzvah. V'chein b'dvar pilegesh b'givah, our story, El Hashem b'mitzvah, they gather to God in mitzvah. V'chein amar Shmuel b'machemes plishtim, and Shmuel said it when they went to war against the plishtim, kivtsu elai kol Yisrael ha-mitzvasa, gather all Israel to me, to mitzvah. And then v'chein kishehimlich Shaul, when he coronated Shaul, Shmuel as ha'am el Hashem ha-mitzvah. Shmuel gathers the nation to God in mitzvah. Niram mikol elah psukim ki mizbeach hayasham. Ubayez mekudash letfilah ulekibutz Yisrael ba'osan hayamim. He says that's the story. That's why it's before God in mitzvah, and that's why they choose that location. It's been a place that we had great victory from Hashem. It's a place where there's a mizbeach from Yahushua, and therefore this is perpetually where we meet. You know, if you didn't adopt this, you could make the suggestion that mitzvah just means a high place, and every time they gather in a different high place. But the way it's presented over and over, and it sounds like there's like a definite object here. It's the mitzvah. It's not just a mitzvah, but it's the mitzvah. And so that's Radak's suggestion, and Abarbanel says similarly in source number 7. Yan hayad bidehem devar mikubal. They had a tradition. Sheba mitzvah tidbak hashgacha elokid me'akadosh baruch hu. That God is found there. That God is available there. That God is going to assist them there. That's the tradition they have going back to the war against Yavin. Kisham nitzach Yoshua hamalachim asher nesfu negdo. Because there Yoshua beat the kings who were gathered against him. V'sham haya mizbeach ubeit filah. And again, they built a mizbeach there. They built a place to pray to God. V'sham haya beisvad liyos Yisrael mekubatzim ki yelahem davar. And that's where the meeting place was for them to gather when there was an issue. So Abarbanel, like Radak, believes that that's what El Hashem means. It isn't some abstract idea that God is present because we're gathering. It's we are gathering to the Mizbeach. We're gathering to the place where God gave us victory in the past. And that's how they choose the site.
Maybe they feel that God is there.
Yeah. No, I think they do. I think they do feel that God is there.
That's where they got, they want.
Right. I think so. Now, there was an odd turn of phrase, which I sort of glossed over in the Hebrew. Go back to Pasuk Bet. Parakhaf Pasuk Bet. Those who have an English translation, the beginning of the sentence, when it says, Vayisyatzavu pinos kol ha'am. So, okay, so Ora's edition has the chiefs of all people gathered. Pinot are chiefs. Okay. So Eti says, aren't pinot corners? Who has a different translation here? Debbie, what do you have?
Okay. It also says, it says chiefs.
Don't give me the commentary at the bottom. Thank you.
Chiefs.
No cheating. Chiefs. Chiefs. And Linda, what do you have in yours? Also chiefs. Okay, so you've got chiefs, chiefs, and chiefs, and I think that represents all the commentaries that we have represented. Okay, so the question is, what in the world does that mean? What do you mean chiefs? So the answer is they're following Rashi. when they say chiefs. I brought it for you in number 10. I didn't translate 8, 9, and 10 because I wanted to fit the translation for 11 on the page. And I felt 8, 9, and 10 could be sacrificed because they're brief. But number 10, you see Rashi there, Pinot kol ha'am, reishei kol ama, right? The heads of the nation. And that's a reasonable translation except for a problem, right? Because Pina is corner. Pina is not chief.
Maybe he's from Pinot kol ha'olam, from all the corners. They came from all corners of the country.
Yeah, but that won't mean chiefs. So I'm going to come back to Rashi to try to explain him based on something that Alina already knows, because we did this
maybe
in
the corner of the room while they're being...
They come from more like Pana, you know, they turn to him.
You turn to them, that's clever. Someone you all turn to. Is the chief, but I think that would be hard to read into Pinot. It's a good idea. I don't think grammatically it works, but I like the idea. So Ramban says that it's corners. Ramban is source number 8 on your sheet. He's writing. What happens is Ramban gives you this whole commentary on Pilagish Begiva in his commentary on Sodom. Once he's talking about the similarities and the differences, he goes through the story. So he says, "Vihine pinot kol ha'am mikol shivtei Yisrael ratzu lasod geder gadol b'davar." He says, "The corners of the entire nation from all the tribes of Israel." So the idea is Jews are gathering from everywhere because everybody is horrified. And that's the emphasis when it says, Vayityatzvu, if you go back to the Pasuk, instead of just saying Vayityatzvu, Kol Yisrael, that all is, or Kol Ha'am, it says Pinot Kol Ha'am, even the people who are far flung. You know, unlike, let's say, with Devorah, where she can't get everybody to gather, or unlike with Gidon, where there are people who are not willing to support and participate, everybody is on board with gathering here. It's all of them. Okay, that's one approach.
I have something here. Should I read it?
You know, hold off, please. Okay. Just like I said to Debbie, because that's the problem. I like the fact that people have commentaries and they're using them, but if you jump into that, then I lose the order of how I want to present it. So the first idea, Ramban's idea, is to say it's emphasizing not just Kol Ha'am, but Pinot Kol Ha'am. Even the corners, the far flung, they're all there. Abarbanel, Mitzudat, David, and Malbim offer a very different approach. They say no. They all gather in corners. Vayityatzvu, effectively what happens is the question is, how do you read the word Pinot? The way Ramban reads it is, Vayityatzvu, Pinot Kol Ha'am. Right? The corners of the nation all gathered. However, the way that Abarbanel reads it is, Vayityatzvu Pinot. They sat in corners, Kol Ha'am. That's the way they...
They're not unified, you're saying.
They are not unified at this stage. Take a look at source number 9. Vihikavetz amim yachdav. When all of the different tribes gathered together, hityatzvu kol hashvatim pinot bifnei atzmam. All the tribes sat in their own corners. Kichana kol sheva pina achat ubitzad nivdal mechavero. Each one sat separately. Now, that's not a good sign, right? Tribal identity is overcoming national unity, but it's going to contrast with what comes next. Because what comes next is, in fact, that they will join together. So it's saying, right now, they're not unified, but they will be. But now let's go back to Rashi. And Rashi's idea that Pinot actually refers to the chiefs, the heads of the nation. And how do we get that to fit with the term Pinot? So, I believe, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to go back a second.
Yeah.
He sent, that nice man sent the pieces of the woman to 12 tribes. I mean, he sent it to Benjamin.
Benjamin knows, I told you. We're coming to it in Pasuk Gimel. Mm-hmm. You got it. Just wait. Or you can look at it Pasuk Gimel if you want.
I'll wait. Okay. Suspense.
We will see Benjamin. So
no, but I'm sorry, but why would he send it to Binyamin too? It was their people.
So, but it's only
them to know what was going on.
So at the answers, because it was one town in Binyamin, and maybe what he wants is for them to be willing to carry out justice.
Okay, so he's not declaring war. He doesn't want a war on Binyamin. He's
correct.
On
what he wants is
he needs to get the entire nation from
one town.
One town.
Yeah. I mean, this is a guy who is now outraged. He can't believe this happened. Granted that he has his own hand in this, and he's just, I'm going to bring down fire. If God won't send fire and brimstone on them, I will myself. That's what he's doing.
400,000 people? Okay.
Yeah. Well, wait and see what happens. But that's the idea. Now,
but as things stand, it didn't happen yet. What happened? What will happen hasn't happened.
Usually.
That's right. We know better. But still, at the same time, it's still 400,000.
Yes.
Okay.
So Rashi's read, though, is fascinating because in Nehemiah Perek Gimel, the third chapter in Nehemiah, I didn't give you a reference on the sheet, but in the third chapter in Nehemiah, it describes the process of building the walls of Yerushalayim. In the beginning of that period of the second Beis HaMikdash, Nehemiah comes back to build the walls, and they describes how each segment of the wall was built by a different group. And at one point, it describes an area called the Ophel, and it's built up in the Pinah. And the way that the commentators, various commentators, look at it there is that Pinah does not mean cornerstone, which is the way we're used to thinking of it, because over there it seems to be elevated. Rather, Pinah means the top, an elevated area. Works with chief very well, number one. But number two, it also explains the pasuk in Tehillim. Right? That we say in Hallel. Eben ma'asua bonim haithala rosh pinah. So we always translate that as the stone that the builders had rejected became the cornerstone. Rosh pinah cannot be a cornerstone. A cornerstone is on the is below everything.
That's right.
What do you mean rosh pinah?
It
doesn't make any sense. Rosh pinah is because pinah is the top. It's an elevated area.
Rosh is
the stone that it... Right. Well, rosh is the top, but the top of the elevated area. That's the idea. The stone that had been left and rejected is now up there, and everybody looks up at it.
I was told that cornerstone is kind of the most important stone, you know, because
right, but then the word rosh. But
it's true. Yeah. No, but I'm thinking rosh in the sense of.
Of importance.
Yeah. Importance.
Right, and that's fine, but I think Pinah means elevated area, and that's why this fits very well to explain Rashi. I think that's what Rashi is doing. He's reading. They say that? What do they say? Now we can read that.
Okay, thank you, Chiefs. Corners. Perhaps the figure is drawn from the corner towers of a city or wall.
Ah, there we go. Okay, fine. I'm glad that I made you wait. I would have taken all the energy out of what I was doing.
Now,
what did you have?
Yeah, so they say that the Lefisha Pinot Habayit Min HaVanim HaGdolot Kanaha Neshim HaGdolim Pinot.
So that the idea to use a larger stone. Who is that?
Radak.
Is it
Radak? Radak Sefer
HaShar HaShem. Oh, Sefer HaShar HaShem. Right, that's Radak's grammar work.
Okay.
He has the mitzvah. Okay, fine. So the people all gather together, and notice how they're described here. They're described as the Am HaElokim. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Right? They are the nation of God. They are zealous for God, and we are going to set things straight. Okay. Well, let's see what happens. Parak Chaf Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3.
And all standing on their feet, on their feet and holding our sword.
Not necessarily. It's describing people who wield swords.
Yes.
I saw somebody, I think it was the Kaufman edition, who says that Jews in general, the period of the Shoftim, don't have high tech. We don't have good weapons. So you have people with swords. But you don't have chariots, you don't have any of the fancy stuff. Right, in Shoftim we're just not armed.
We have Hashem.
Right. We have God. Well, in this case, we could have used him earlier. Had we had God earlier, we turned to God earlier, this wouldn't have happened. But the Pasuk says, Vayishma'u b'nei Binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael ha-mitzvah. Actually, come to think of it, I think that's actually an interesting point. This idea that they're sholeif cherev, that they wield swords, right? At least they have swords. Meaning, we've made a point at various times within this book that generally speaking, we don't have swords even. Right? We had the cattle goad, or we had the special left-handed dagger, or we had the jawbone of a donkey. Right?
Well, they've learned from experience.
This is earlier.
So is this the first time they mention cherev?
Probably not. But I think it's interesting to see when it comes to fighting our own, we suddenly have swords.
No, but they fought before the Canaanim
Barak fought them and Gideon fought them and so.
Well, in Gideon's time is a perfect example. They didn't have much.
So how did they fight?
Maybe it's also
with crude weapons and whatever they could get together. Yeah.
Maybe it's also a euphemism or a name for soldiers.
Maybe.
Could those who.
Yeah. Could be. Okay, so let's take a look at Pasuk Gimel, because I told you we were going to see Gimel, so we have to see Gimel. Vayishma'u b'nei Binyamin, kialu b'nei Yisrael ha-mitzpah. So Binyamin knows that everybody else is gathering in mitzpah. They don't go. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael dabru echa nihiyatah ra'ah hazot. And the Jews turned, the Jews who have gathered, turned to the Levi and say, tell us exactly what happened. So here's my question to you. What happened mid-sentence?
It's like two things. Two.
Why is this one sentence?
Yeah.
So I'll give you one approach, and then we'll come back next time, God willing, to go further with it. But take a look on your sheet at source number 11 at Abarbanel. Most people just read this as an interlude. Binyamin heard and didn't do anything about what happened in their
midst. Punctuation.
Yeah. Take a look at Abarbanel, though.
No,
he says
punctuation in the Bible, so maybe.
Yeah.
It
maybe that's
a punctuation that it wasn't.
Oh no! Just so they just read it as informing us. Binyamin knew what was going on. But take a look at 11, Abarbanel. Lefi shezei yisaper acharkach ech shalchu aleihem bnei Yisrael malachim velo shamu aleihem bnei Binyamin, because it's going to tell next. How the Jews sent messengers and Binyamin didn't listen to them. We haven't seen that yet. They're going to send messengers directly to Binyamin. Achshov, you know what I think? Shepirush vayishme'u b'nei Binyamin hu shenizkabtzu heim b'neihem. Lafish nizkabtzu b'nei Yisrael. Vayishme'u does not mean they heard. Vayishme'u means they gathered. The Jews gathered and Binyamin gathered. Now keep reading. He brings you cases that we have in Tanakh, particularly in Navi, where Shin Mem Ayin does not just mean listen, but it actually means to gather. I didn't bring you all of his sources, but I gave you the one from the war against Amalek. When Shaul gathers the nation to fight Amalek, it says Vayishama Shaul Esa'am, and it means they gathered, because the next clause in the sentences, and he counted them, and so on. Yisaper HaKasuv Shemiyad Sheyisrael Nesfu B'Mitzpah Niskabtzu Gam Kein B'nei Binyamin Kulam Ba'arehem. The Jews are gathering in Mitzpah. Binyamin gathers in their cities. V'hu Mimash Sheyoresh Sheyad Ume HaDavar Hara HaHushana Asan. The point is, that means they knew exactly what had happened. V'lachin Nis Nikbitzu La'amod Al Nafsham. And therefore they said, we better defend ourselves. And so what it's trying to set up here is, Binyamin is rallying among themselves, and now the Jews are going to find out exactly what happened and determine how they want to deal with it. But it's setting up, it's not just random, oh, and Binyamin knew, you know, Binyamin heard what was going on. It's, and Binyamin was getting ready for war.
But they got a part of the body.
Yes. And that's probably by, that's probably how they heard. I would think that's how they heard. They got a message.
But that came before. Before they all gathered.
So why didn't they gather in the first place like everybody else?
So that's the thing. They've decided they're not going with everybody else to mitzvah. They are doing this defensively.
Well,
mitzvah
is
in Ephraim. Binyamin is south. Binyamin is south of Ephraim.
Because
Ephraim is here. Mm-hmm. Binyamin is here. And there's going to be a war between all the licorice and the
and they're bigger.
Yeah.
Why does Binyamin take that side? Why doesn't Binyamin say there was a few people in Giva or a gang of people and they did something wrong? Why don't they take the side of everybody else?
Good question. So why doesn't Binyamin do this? What's the answer?
They have to protect their own.
Ein melech b'Yisrael. There is no king. There is no law and order. And
nobody should talk.
Ish ha'yashar b'einav yaaseh. That's the problem. So we will pick up, God willing, next time. You had a question, Ricky, that you wanted to ask.